Welcome to Political Rewind. We have a big agenda today. And so while I usually kind of like to give our panelists, because they're always so smart, plenty of opportunity to talk at length about every issue, we're going to blow through topics today and try to keep on track. So you know what? If we're not doing it, tweet us. Tell us what we're doing wrong. PoliticsGPB is our handle. And you know, always we'd love to hear from you. Jim Galloway is with me, as he is on Mondays and Fridays. You know him as the political writer, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He's in the paper on Thursdays and Sundays and oversees the AJC Political Insider blog. Preview time. What are you going to write for Sunday?
Do I have time to read this quote from Johnny Isaacson?
Sure.
On healthcare. You have to do away with the individual mandate and then define what the new individual mandate is.
That's really interesting. That'll be in Jim's column on Sunday. We talked a bit about that with Georgia Health News' Andy Miller the other day. We should point out Jim Galloway got that quote over a lunch with Isaacson. Where'd you have lunch?
The Bluegill?
Blue Ridge Grill.
Blue Ridge Grill.
Very upscale.
There we are.
Very upscale, Jim.
Separate checks.
We're also really glad to be joined by Jason Carter. You know that Jason was the Democratic candidate for governor in the 2014 race. He is an attorney at one of the one of the Southeast's finest law firms, Bondurant Mixon. And he also is the title chairman of the Jimmy Carter Presidential Center. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
And I got to say, I don't mean to correct you right off the bat, but it's just the Carter Center because Rosalynn and Jimmy would both be disappointed in you.
I apologize. It would not be the first time that I've done something that disappointed your grandfather.
That makes two of us.
And Chip Lake is with us as well, a Republican strategist.
Happy to be here,
and
Bill. Thanks for having
me. Long-time participant in this show. I got a couple of quick headlines that I want to read, and then we're going to move right into our conversation. And they both relate to Georgians. This morning, the official announcement came down that Brenda Fitzgerald, who was the head of the State Department of Public Health, she's a public commissioner, public health commissioner for the state of Georgia, has been appointed now to serve as director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Galloway, that's a huge job.
It's a huge job, and it's kind of it's unusual. Let's say that to take somebody out of the state structure and put them at the top of the CDC.
Yeah, well, you would have to imagine that that Tom Price, HHS Secretary Tom Price, would have had some role in identifying her. I though remember that back in 1994, Brenda Fitzgerald was a Republican candidate for congressional seat up in the 7th district, and she was famous at the time because she and Newt Gingrich, who was, I think, minority, he hadn't stepped into the speaker's role at that point because it was that election where he finally got the votes he needed. They did a really interesting photo op. They staged a Boston Tea Party of their own, throwing crates of tea into the Chattahoochee River together. It's been so long ago, I don't remember
I think this was way back when everybody was throwing everything into the Chattahoochee River. Yeah.
But Brenda decided after that election, she lost the primary to Bob Barr. And I think she decided to move on from partisan politics. But she was an interesting candidate to cover. You remember those days, Chip?
Indeed. And I remember her running against Bob Barr. I forgot it was I forgot who the general election component was there. But the CDC is under the Department of HHS. So I imagine Tom Price did make a recommendation to the administration and probably got rubber stamped. The announcement was made today. So congratulations to Brenda Fitzgerald.
Yeah, and I'll just say, I mean, all of us in Atlanta and, you know, the Carter Center and others in the public health world are going to watch really closely. This is an incredibly important institution for us here in Georgia, for our place in the world, and so we'll all be pulling for her.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. The Carter Center for Global Health has been one of the real world leaders in fighting often neglected diseases, many of them in tropical countries, guinea worm particularly, which your people, if I've got this right, Jason, are on the verge of eradicating. An astonishing feat.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's, and again, this just demonstrates that Atlanta's place in the world is an important one, and global health is one of those areas. But yes, the Carter Center and through many partnerships with CDC and others are on the verge of eradicating the second human disease ever eradicated.
Yeah, smallpox being the only other disease that was eradicated. And that done, led by Bill Foege, who became one of the people who helped found the Carter Center for Global Health.
That's right, all of which is through the CDC. So exactly. That this heritage is there. She's got big shoes to fill.
Producer Lisa Clark is saying, you're already wandering instead of getting to the agenda. She's gesturing. So we will get to the agenda. We're going to talk briefly about President Trump and his meeting with Vladimir Putin. Let's set it up, though, by going back to July 29th, 1959. Nikita Khrushchev and Vice President Richard Nixon were together at an American exhibition, an exhibition of American everyday technology, like fancy microwave ovens and big fancy refrigerators. And they got into a debate that, when you listen to the audio I'm going to play you, sounds playful and fun. But the vice president came away with great praise for confronting Khrushchev on some significant issues of which country honored freedom of the press and believed in free speech.
We have every word that you have said, every word that you have said has been taken down. And I will promise you that every word that you have said here will be reported in the United States, and they will see you say it on television. Certainly it will. Certainly.
Yes.
Right. In fact, and with the same token, everything that I say will be recorded and translated and will be carried all over the Soviet Union. That's a fair bargain.
They were laughing, but Vice President Nixon made his point. Free speech, freedom of the media in the United States, not so much, Jim, in the Soviet Union.
No. And of course, this is all in the background of Donald Trump's first trip into Europe. We still know that he met today with Vladimir Putin for, what, 2 hours and 15 minutes?
2 hours, scheduled for 30 minutes, although everybody tells us that they schedule a short meeting just in case things go off track and they don't want to continue.
Right.
So they did meet for 2 hours, 15 minutes. Secretary of State Tillerson came out and talked to the press afterward. He said that the first thing that the president brought up with Putin was, in fact, Russian interference, or the question of Russian interference with the election. Putin said there was no interference. We didn't hack into your election system. And Tillerson essentially said, and I'm indirectly quoting him, we may never get to the bottom of this, but we do have to figure out how to make sure that we don't have this sort of thing happen again. Sort of a surprising outcome in some ways, Chip.
I think it was surprising. I mean, there was a question going into the meeting as to whether or not he was going to address that at all, because Donald Trump was the beneficiary of the Russian hacking into the election and the efforts that they made to influence the election. And so I think I was pretty pleased. I've been on the show and I've been very critical of the president as a Republican. And, we're only 2.5 hours removed from the conclusion of that meeting. So we'll have to see how it plays out. But it certainly looks like it was a success. And the AP is reporting that Melania tried to break the meeting up at the 1 hour mark and opened the door and did not conclude. It lasted another hour and 15 minutes. So
I'm guessing with these things that I'm guessing that at least at the front end, Trump was reading from a prepared script, and Tillerson was right there with him, and this had probably had been worked out before. That's just a guess, but it's going to take a couple of weeks for us to really figure
that's
out
right.
what happened.
And that's why we're not going to
worked out with the Russians, or worked out internally with the senior staff.
With the senior staff, because Tillerson was right there.
Sure.
Too.
Now, what in the history of the world makes you think that Donald Trump would work from a prepared text of any kind?
Well, no, Jason's right. I mean,
I don't think anybody knew.
I said it first.
No, Jason's right, which I think he is the master at lowering expectations, whether or not he does it on purpose or whether or not he does it because of other activities that he has.
Well,
going
I'm glad
on
you said that, because that's what I wanted to ask you about, Jason. It struck me that we shouldn't have been surprised that President Trump would bring up possible meddling, because he already knew in advance that Putin would say, no, 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 niet, niet, we did not interfere. And that would, in fact, we'll see how this plays out. Tillerson's comments suggest maybe there was some real conversation, but the president can go back to the United States and say, oh, I pressed him on it. They didn't interfere. I mean, it doesn't seem to me as surprising as some people think it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's if the expectations are so low, that we're worried that the president of the United States won't raise a fundamental question about Russian interference in our democracy with the leader of Russia, then what have the expectations come to? I mean, that's the minimum that he had to do. I mean, it was to raise the most pressing, certainly public issue with respect to Russia. Now, I hope that he addressed the issues of Syria. I hope we're going to talk about that later, because while we all as Democrats care what Donald Trump and Russia have going on, the actual issues between our countries...
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. That is the other headline that comes out of this meeting, and we'll learn more about this as the days go by. There was an apparent informal agreement, Jim, for Russia and the United States to start a ceasefire on Sunday in southwest Syria. What I think we're going to learn more about is why that particular part of Syria, and already there is speculation that, in fact, this works to the Russian advantage, because that is where Assad's seat of government exists, and therefore it's in his interest to have at least a temporary ceasefire there.
And we saw some this was in motion well before the summit meeting. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, that the U.S. gets some territorial protection for its partisans in there.
Yeah, well, we'll watch all that as it develops.
But I will tell you, I mean, I think for us here today, I think Trump's speech in Warsaw is probably the best measure of what's going on in his head right now.
Wait, give us a quick description.
Well,
I don't know
if you watched that speech.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, of course, he said, you know, in a press conference afterwards, he said maybe there was Russian interference, maybe there wasn't, but it was a speech where his vision. He transferred his American Carnage speech and put it in Europe. Basically, you know, does the West have the will to survive?
Yeah, he gave a speech that the Poles would love because of the nationalistic nature of their government right now. So it's not a surprise he would give that speech there.
Yeah, well, and some of the Poles will love it. But again, you know, you have to remember that Poland is a deeply divided country right now. The nationalist government has done an enormous amount to divide the country and to polarize the country, like the United States, in my view. And so, you know, to the extent that it demonstrates what's in his head, I think that's true, Jim. But, you know, whether it's helpful, whether it further isolates the United States, I mean, to me, the biggest news out of the other day was the fact that the EU and Japan are now in serious trade talks that are going to cut the U.S. out. I mean, what are we gaining?
Well,
at this point?
Germany and China are developing warmer relations around trade, with Trump kind of cutting himself out of the picture. Do you want to weigh in quickly?
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, we're not even six months in, because he got inaugurated at, the middle towards the end of January. So we're almost 6 months into this administration. And he's really had three times during his presidency where he's, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but looked presidential, like other presidents of other parties look presidential. I think the first time was during the inauguration speech. The second time is when he went on his first international trip, which I think by all accounts exceeded expectations of what we all thought was going to happen.
Well, in Saudi Arabia, I don't think you would would agree in Western Europe.
Well, that's right. It was a long trip, there were a lot of us that were terrified as he was getting on the plane to head over there. And it does look like so far in this trip, he has followed whatever script his staff has written out.
That's
for
right.
Him.
And we'll see as G20 progresses.
Whether or not he can do that.
That's right. That's going to be fascinating, because those meetings are really just getting underway even as we sit here. By the way, just to close this out, very strange last night on the eve of his meeting with Putin. Here's what President Trump decided to tweet. Everyone here is talking about why John Podesta refused to give the DNC server to the FBI and the CIA. Disgraceful. I'm sure Merkel, I'm sure Macron, I'm sure they're all talking about John Podesta there.
My understanding is that when he tweets and says everyone here, he's in a room by himself.
Yeah, okay.
What else is in the room is up to you guys.
It's just another example. We cannot fathom sometimes What is in this man's
head? You know, the reply from Podesta today was, get your head in the game, man.
There you go. Let's move on. We'll cover this very quickly, but it's worth covering. Walter Schaub, who's been the director of the United States Office of Government Ethics, he was due to resign his post fairly soon, I think the end of the year. He's been a Trump critic all along. He finally decided he had to get out because he feels... Let's listen to what he said, actually.
I can't know what their intention is. I know that the effect is that there's an appearance that the businesses are profiting from his occupying the presidency. And appearance matters as much as reality.
Okay, so that's Walter Schaub, and it continues to spotlight a focus on possible conflicts of interest that the president has so far been more than happy to allow to continue. Jim Galloway, we know that next week, an Atlanta man, Christopher Wray, is going to be in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee to be have confirmation hearings to become FBI director.
And I would think that he's going to be on a fast track to be to get full Senate confirmation by the end of July before the August recess.
You have a great story about that you posted today on the Political Insider blog about the case that he told in his application or in his papers.
This came first from the Washington Times, which looked at the questionnaire that nominees are required to fill out just to give senators some fodder for questions later on at the hearings, and it asked, what was your most memorable case? And his answer was the jailing of former ex-Brave Pat Jarvis.
Pat Jarvis, then sheriff of
DeKalb County for taking kickbacks.
Yeah.
Back in 1999. This is a guy who has got a September 11th terrorist in prison right now. This is the guy who I think he defended Chris Christie.
In the Bridgegate.
And he says, Pat Jarvis.
That's right.
That just goes to show that when you're facing Senate confirmation, it's always okay to pick on DeKalb County. my home county.
So you're in the lawyer community. Chris Wray's reputation among attorneys.
I am in the lawyer community. I'm a well-known Democrat. Chris is not. Everyone that I know thinks very highly of him. He's a straight shooter. He's incredibly smart. I've never heard anybody say anything but good stuff about Chris Wray. So that begs the question that Chip was asking earlier.
Why do you want this job?
Why would you want the job under these circumstances with this president? I don't get it. I thought they would have a very difficult job finding somebody. I certainly didn't think they would find somebody with the stature and the reputation of Chris Wray. So I guess I'm happy for him from a regional perspective. I guess it's good for Georgia. But we'll have to wait to see how it plays out. He's walking into a very difficult situation, a no-win situation.
I believe he's a public servant. I really do. And that's in his heart. And that's why he's doing it. It's because if the good people don't do it, then who's going to?
Speaking of the Justice Department, Sally Yates has been pretty quiet in terms of talking about President Trump, but she's gone active on Twitter criticizing him for not acknowledging the Russia the hacks.
Right. Oh, and we should note here that Pat Jarvis investigation, Chris Wray worked with Sally Yates on that one.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That's probably not going to come out in your hearings.
He was convicted for a bribery scheme, a kickback scheme that netted him something like $200,000. But it is interesting, Jim, that Sally Yates has decided now's the time to become public again in her criticism of the president. Or not again, but now.
Yeah, and of course, it raises the question of what's next for.
Yeah. Well, I still maintain this is not someone who wants to run for elective office. It simply is not in her nature, but we'll see. Yes, Jason?
No, I agree. I don't think she's going to do it. I think she would do a good job at whatever it is she's going to be next. And if you know, the people I work with are an indication, we'd all like her to come work for us.
There you go. I can't imagine there is a law firm anywhere in this city, in the state, in the southeast, and far beyond that wouldn't like to have Sally Yates as a partner. So we'll see what happens. Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we have a couple things we're going to turn to. I want to talk to Jason Carter about his decision not to run for governor this time around, and more important, what he sees as the next, what's going to happen with the governor's race. And then we're going to talk to Jared Sexton. He's down in South Georgia, and he is the man who unmasked the guy who created the GIF, however you say it, the animation of Trump beating up CNN, and the hate, the responses, the trolling, the hate trolling has been pretty overwhelming. And we want to get to him before the end of this show today. So let's take a quick break right now and come right back with a lot more.
Hi, I'm Nina Totenberg. Are you someone who talks about how great public radio is, but you're still not a donor? Rather than wait for the next pledge drive, you can support the programs you love by donating that unwanted vehicle. It's served you well over the years and can still get you around town, but let's face it, it's just taking up space. Donate it today. It could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station, and you could get a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
Thank you for choosing Georgia Public Broadcasting. We're an 18-station radio network of GPB. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, ranked among the top universities in the nation in commitment to undergraduate teaching. I'm Ellen Reinhart. Thank you for joining me.
We're back on Political Rewind. Jason Carter joins us today. So does Chip Lake. And Jim Galloway, of course, is with us. Couple of quick tweets. Robert Jimison, you'll remember he was one of our star interns. He says, Dr. Fitzgerald, Brenda Fitzgerald, donated to Price's campaigns on at least three occasions, according to FEC records. Jimison doing our work for us, Galloway.
Interesting. And we don't have to pay him.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we never did. He was an intern. So we'll get to more as we go on. Jason Carter, you ran a race that in 2014. You were... The Democrats thought you were a terrific candidate. You obviously were. And unfortunately for Democrats, it didn't go the way you wanted it to. Why did you decide that you didn't want to get into the ring again this year, other than the fact that on the 4th of July holiday, you were not out at hot 4th of July parades? You could be with your family.
Actually, we don't know that he wasn't out at 4th of July
parades.
No,
I'll bet he wasn't.
I was not at a 4th of July parade, but not because I don't love my country.
Right.
I think politics, it takes a lot out of you on a personal level. My kids are 8 and 10. As I said the other day, that sort of prime dad time, and I'm having such a good time with them. It's important for me and my family to have them around. And that's the primary driver. I think the other, and it's one that we were discussing off the air a little bit, this moment in our history as a state, this moment in our politics, it's one that's just hard to get a handle on. And I believe that the national politics are really disturbing. And I don't mean just because I'm a Democrat and I'm disturbed by what the president is doing or things like that. I mean the way that we'll get to Jared Sexton later. Well, there's a variety of things that are going on, but I just don't have a feel right now that this was my time. And if it's not, you got to step back. And the two women that are running for the Democratic nomination are dynamic, remarkable people. And I frankly think if I were handicapping the race right now, that they've got a better shot than anybody else out there.
I think I speak for most Republicans to say that we were surprised that Jason Carter didn't decide to run for governor. We all kind of thought in 2014 that going to step up, run against an incumbent, and catch lightning in a bottle, end up winning. Great. If not, I set myself up. The state's changing demographically. There are a lot of Republicans, a lot of people on my side of the aisle that are just becoming complacent and just believe this is a red state in perpetuity, and it's not, and it's going to be very competitive. And I think this governor's race will be competitive as well, both on the primary, on the Republican side, and then I think we're going to have to work very hard to make sure we keep this seat and keep Georgia a red state.
Jim, I'm glad to have Jason Carter here. He sent an email. You don't mind if I share the email you sent us? You sent an email after I sent out some ideas about the show. You said, my debut is a pundit. And frankly, I'm really glad to have you here in that role, you know? So yeah, thanks for not running this time around.
Yeah. I'm coming for you, Jim.
Jim,
I'm headed to law school.
I think both of us would be poorly served.
So you don't find this surprising, but I think a lot of people like me who are not as aware of some of the background dynamics, The mayor, Mayor Kasim Reed, sent out it. We've got Stacey Evans and Stacey Abrams, both positioned to be
right.
major candidates.
Both House members.
Yeah. And we know that Stacey Evans is starting to line up some pretty significant endorsements. I mean, Roy Barnes has endorsed her officially. She's gotten a couple others, too, and I can't think of them off the top of my head. But Kasim Reed the other day made a comment about how she has a really interesting story or something of to that effect.
He sat down for a discussion with her, said she had a powerful story. And, of course, the backstory there is 8 years ago, Stacey Abrams was running Lisa Borders' campaign when Lisa Borders was running for mayor of Atlanta against many people, but including Kasim Reed.
So this is not, Chip, an endorsement, obviously.
Right.
Nevertheless, at this early stage in the race,
you're going to find people being very, very cautious about how they approach this. This because, of course, Stacey Abrams of Atlanta is African American. Stacey Evans of Smyrna is white, and it kind of this is where Democrats. Democrats' strength is a biracial coalition. It's also their fault line.
Well, the only thing I would say to that is, I would never assume that because Stacey Abrams is African-American, she's going to lock up the African-American vote. I mean, one of the things that Stacey Abrams has to prove is that she's going to be able to get support here in Georgia. She's going to be able to raise money here in Georgia. She has a great national reputation. She's a compelling human being. She's super smart. She's all of that. But she needs to prove that she's got the support of folks here in Georgia. And I would not assume that she would get African-American vote from the leadership, from rank and file or anyone just because she's African-American. I mean, that's something that Stacey Evans is going to play for, and it will be interesting to watch. But to your point, Jim, there may be people who are waiting to get sort of permission to come out against Stacey Abrams if that's what they want to do. You will be interesting to watch.
Yeah, but that's why, Chip, I think this comment by the mayor, he may say something similar about Stacey Abrams. Who
right.
knows? And if he does, we'll certainly know. Jim Galloway saying not a chance. Okay. Nevertheless, that's why I find this an interesting statement to make at this time.
I'm a little surprised that we're having this conversation this early. And what I mean by that is I thought it would be a lot further along in the year until the Democratic primary for governor really got going. But I tell you why I think it got going was because of the 16 Homes video that Stacey Evans released, which was a powerful statement and testimony of the situation that she ran into, raised by a single mom up, I believe, in Ringgold in North Georgia. And I think it's a 3 or 4 minute video that's gotten national attention.
And that was included in the mayor's Twitter message. I mean, he attached the video to it. But Republicans are kind of they're looking at Stacey Evans as potential trouble,
terrified.
I was at the Cobb County GOP 4th of July gathering on Tuesday, and Casey Cagle got up and he's kind of started to enhance his upbringing a little bit. You know, he said I went to eight elementary schools when I was growing up. I grew up in a trailer, too. Now, he's emphasized that before, but it had a little more juice to it this time.
Yeah, I mean, Republicans shouldn't underestimate anybody, but I don't know that it's a secret that I think, at least early on in this race, Stacey Evans would make would be the tougher candidate for the Republican nominee.
So, Jason, what's the message?
Well, it's hard to sit around, you know, a table sometimes and talk about some of these things, especially when you're sitting here, you know,
when you were the nominee of the party 4 years ago. It's tough
decision. Well, no. My point is different, I think. The good thing about not running is I can say whatever I want
to.
But my only point is Democrats sit down and talk about race. We will sit down and talk about gender. You know, the bottom line is I see it. Stacey Evans' story is compelling.
It is.
Stacey Abrams' story is also compelling. But, and you know, how we address that, how we package that, in my view, like, who are the compelling people on the other side? I mean, Casey Cagle, yes, has an interesting backstory, but he's been a lieutenant governor for 12 years. He's talking about a bold vision. That must just be new glasses because he's gotten and been here for 12 years and been in politics for 22. The taxpayers have been driving him to work every day for 12 years. It's hard to drive that home. And the folks on the Democratic side right now are going to have an interesting race. I think it's going to be a compelling story, both sides.
And that's why on the Republican side, I would suggest that people start looking at Hunter Hill.
All right, I'm glad you brought that up. Let's talk about it for a minute. We had our first reporting period, and we've gotten some public disclosures out there since the filing period ended. Hunter Hill said he raised more than $1 million. Tell us who he is, Jim.
Yeah, he's a four-year state senator, lives in Atlanta, kind of the greater Vinings area, I would suppose. Went to Westminster High School, then to West Point, has joined up with the 101st Airborne, did a tour in Iraq and in Afghanistan, I think. It's kind of a different kind of outsider for Republicans. It doesn't fit the businessman mold.
He's got a phenomenal profile. What we don't know yet is of the $1 million, how much was a personal loan or contribution from himself?
Exactly.
How much was he able to raise? Either way, it's very impressive. And I think while we're on the subject, too, we don't know what Casey Cagle's numbers are. The lieutenant governor will release them. He has to release them by the end of the day on Monday. But Brian Kemp raised $1.7 million. And mm-hmm. I think both Brian Kemp and Hunter Hill exceeded fundraising expectations. That puts a lot of pressure on the lieutenant governor to not only match what they did, but far exceed it.
Yeah, I mean, my thought is Casey Cagle's probably sitting on $3 million. I mean, you know, he's been raising money.
Raising expectations, that Democrat Jason Carter.
bravo.
But Jason, your point is really a good one. If the lieutenant governor, the incumbent lieutenant governor, doesn't have a really big showing, this is not a good sign for him, is it?
You know, having been in a governor's race and having felt the pressure of a fundraising deadline, it is amazing the way that it changes the narrative, especially in the media. I mean, we outraised Governor Deal when he was the sitting governor in one of the quarters. I forget which quarter.
Right.
And it just changed everything. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, the story was, wow, this guy's got a chance, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, it really does drive that narrative. Casey knows that, and I bet you he's done well.
I think you're, before we get off governors altogether, I think you're in an. It seems to me you've put yourself in a really good protective position. Obviously, this isn't the reason you did it, but as the chairman of the Carter Center, I mean, people are going to want you to weigh in on who you
and
want to be governor.
And he can't.
And you really are not going to be in any position to do that. That's really a shame, isn't it, Jason?
Well, look, there's a lot of important work out there, and I'm really excited. As I've told everybody who's asked me, I'm for Stacey.
Right. One other quick election note. Jim Galloway, a panelist on this show on a number of occasions, has thrown his hat in the ring to be Secretary of State. Our good friend, Josh McCoon of Columbus. That's going to be an interesting race to watch.
And you know what? He's already talking about dumping the electronic voting system that we've got and going back to the scanner system.
You know what's interesting? All right, so you're the Republican in the room. He has been a controversial figure, not just with the opposite party. Republicans have had trouble over the years with him.
A tremendous amount of trouble with him. This is a rehab exercise for Josh McCoon. He picked an office to run for in which religious liberty is not going to be an issue and discussed. And this is a rehab assignment.
That's a fascinating. I hadn't even thought about that.
All I will say is I served with him in the state Senate for a long time. Do not underestimate him.
Sure.
He's one
of the hardest working guys in the Senate.
And I have watched him face a hostile crowd, and I've watched him face a happy crowd, and he's the real deal.
All right. Can we do this? Let's take a break. Jared Sexton is on the line, and he's been very patient and waiting for us. And we really do want to talk to him. But why don't we get our final break out of the way and come back and have the conversation about the man who exposed the CNN fight video that Donald Trump was so proud to retweet. We'll be right back.
Nevada Senator Dean Heller promised to repeal and replace Obamacare when he ran for office in 2012. Now, some Republicans in the state wonder, what's the holdup?
Get some business done. You know, oh, we can't do this, I can't do that. Quit Mickey Mousing around. Get some work done, okay?
I'm Kelly McEvers. Our report from Nevada this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Hear All Things Considered from 4 till 7 this afternoon on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Jason Carter, Chip Lake, and Jim Galloway are with us. By the way, Jim Galloway will be posting the audio of this show at some point, as if he doesn't have enough to do, on the Political Insider blog. So if you're listening now and you want your friends to hear the show, if you want to hear Jason Carter talk again about why he didn't run for governor, you want your friends to hear that, you can go to the Political Insider
blog. And I just might doctor the audio there for a little bit.
The remix,
of course,
the Galloway
of
remix.
Course, the Galloway Fake News Express. I want to read a tweet because I think it's funny. Corn Dog, who tweets at Dogs for Corn, says, Carter trying to be a fill-in for, quote, Uncle Buddy, unquote. That's our great panelist and friend, Buddy Darden. And all I can say is, you don't have to try to fill his shoes because nobody quite can, but you are your own person and we're glad you're here.
Well, thanks. I could never fill in for Buddy because I talk about twice as fast as he does. Get to say a lot more.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. But anyhow, I thought that was a fun tweet to read to all of you. Tweet us at PoliticsGPB. And you know what? If you're not following us, please do. We'd love to have you do that. All right. We've been saying for a while now that Jared Sexton was going to join us on the show. He's a professor at Georgia Southern University. Are you on the line, Jared?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much for being patient. Let me, if I can, just quickly summarize the conversation or the story here. We all know that one of the strangest tweets we've ever seen from the president was his tweet about showing him wrestling to the ground, fighting with an avatar for CNN. It came out of the WWE video of him actually doing that a few years ago. And you're the one who unmasked the person who created that animation, that GIF or GIF, however you say it. Fair enough?
That's pretty accurate, yeah.
So tell us about first how you went about that process. I'd rather not name him, if that's okay with you. I'd rather not give him attention, and his name also is somewhat obscene. His Twitter handle's obscene. So is it okay if we don't name him?
Yeah, that's perfectly fine. I think there are rules against that anyway.
All right. So how did you go about doing that? And then let's talk about what the consequences were.
Sure. Not too long after the ridiculous wrestling GIF was posted, somebody had mentioned that over on a subreddit called The Donald, which is where a lot of extreme fans of the president gather and talk about him and his enemies, that it had been said that somebody was taking credit for this, and everyone was pointing towards this one user that we will not name. And it literally only took a couple of minutes to figure out not only who it was, but to also find that this poster had a pretty extensive history of publishing really offensive memes and comments.
Tell us some of the things that you discovered he had been putting out on that Reddit account.
I mean, it was a lot of racial slurs, a lot of talk about eliminating Muslims from the world, and the big meme that I actually found, it was one of the few other mentions he had about CNN, was a picture of CNN's on-air talent, and it had little stars of David next to, I suppose, the Jewish members of CNN. And I think that meme sort of painted the wrestling meme in a little bit of a different light.
What does that mean, it painted it? Oh, you mean it painted it our understanding of the kind of person who posted this thing. Yeah, I apologize. I get what you're saying now. What was the reaction when you took this guy public?
Well, at first, I think it was a lot of surprise that the president would end up reposting somebody like this. And you know, I think there's been a lot of conversation about whether or not this was vetted, whether or not his social media apparatus understood exactly who was being given attention. But almost immediately, within about a half hour, I started receiving a lot of threats, intimidation, harassment from neo-Nazis, white nationalists, ethno-identitarians, whatever they're calling themselves now. And that started rolling in pretty much immediately.
I think you told either Lisa Clark or our associate producer, Olivia Reingold, that today was a day where you only got like four death threats. Were you being sarcastic, or is that true?
Yeah, it's been a slow day so far. I've been getting the death threats on Twitter and email, but they've actually moved on to my cell phone, which is a delightful new chapter in this whole thing.
Yeah. Hey, Jeff, let me ask you. Yes, we know that stuff on the internet can get very, very rough very quickly, but Statesboro is I would guess that's pretty strong Trump territory. I mean, from the physical world, what kind of response have you gotten?
Well, you know, it's been varied. I've received harassment at different times. About a year ago, I got a little bit of attention for covering some Trump rallies, and I actually had a few people trying to break into my house. I had people circling it, showing up in my driveway. I've had things yelled at me, but, you know, in the physical world, it hasn't been much outside of a few letters and envelopes showing up here and there, but otherwise it hasn't shown up outside of now the phone situation.
No, have you got family? I mean, are you?
Yeah.
I mean, who live with you? I'm saying.
I've got loved ones who have had a little bit here and there, but it hasn't exactly bled over into them. I understand the CNN journalist who wrote the article about the actual Redditor has received dozens of threatening phone calls, and luckily it's just been focused on me so far.
Well, here's where the story gets even more bizarre, Chip. And Jason, so CNN is now being accused of trying to blackmail the guy who created this animation, this GIF, saying that if he will withdraw that GIF, am I got this right? If he will withdraw that and all of his other comments about CNN, they will not post his name. And that's getting currency on Reddit and other social media platforms as well, despite the fact that CNN absolutely denies that. Right, Jared?
That's right. There's been a strange disinformation campaign that's actually been going through this. The actual poster, it turns out, was a middle-aged man, but a lot of people, including the president's own son, Donald Trump Jr., has been perpetuating this idea that it's a 15-year-old. And so what's actually happened is you've seen a conflating of disinformation and the actual story. And so you have a lot of people who are now calling for myself, who had nothing to do with this outing or not outing, whatever you want to call it, basically have come after us saying that we're blackmailing a 15-year-old, which is wrong on so many accounts I can't really keep track at this point.
Jason, you want to jump in?
Yeah. Well, Jared, it's Jason Carter. I hope you're doing well. I noticed something you tweeted about the other day. I mean, the real story here to me is not that there are people out there who make these things or there's people out there who say crazy stuff. It's that it got brought into the mainstream via the president of the United States' own Twitter account. And that's sort of the thing that nobody can believe. The fact that we're now talking about fake news is fake news. I mean, yeah, that's all very meta, but the real point that I know you mentioned the other day is, you know, how does something like this get in front of the president enough for him to tweet it out? Have you found anything else out about that?
You know, I haven't, and I've been waiting on that question to be asked because it's quite upsetting. It took me less than 10 minutes to find the anti-Semitic meme, but there's also an interesting little thing that happened here, and I don't know if you all remember it, but there was actually an anti-Semitic tweet that Donald Trump retweeted 1 year ago to the day of that GIF in which it showed Hillary Clinton in front of piles of cash next to a Star of David, and it was actually 1 year to the day, and that hasn't stopped. There's been a lot of white nationalists and white supremacists who somehow or another have found their work retweeted by the president and his satellite of associates.
So this is Jason again. Chip, let me ask you a question. Does something like this matter in a broader political context? I mean, to me, it's outrageous that the president gets in this. It's a massive distraction at a minimum. You know, what are you telling candidates or Republicans in Georgia? Just tell me how y'all handle this, you know, when it happens.
Well, I mean, if you're a Republican candidate, you have everything Trump you got to handle so carefully because you can't go out and be overly critical. Even though you want to be in private, and even though you are in private, because the backlash is such that as the professor had said on this show, you're going to deal with, especially if your name's on the ballot. But you don't want to wrap both arms around him too. I mean, look, he's the president of the United States. He's the leader of our party, whether we like it or not, and we have to deal with it. And so, what I think is most surprising about this story is two things. Number one, that CNN hasn't released his name so far. I in many respects feel like they have an obligation to almost. And then number two, the fact that we would live in a time in which to Jason's point, if the president of the United States is going to retweet something like that, pretty good chance, and I'm not taking a position as to whether or not it's the right thing to release his name or not, but pretty good chance you're not going to be able to remain anonymous. And so far, that's happened.
I'm sorry.
I think that's exactly right. I think at some point, you know, in the next 2 or 3 weeks, you're going to see an article in The Atlantic, you're going to see or National Review, some medium that's going to go deep on this, and it's going to have a Tennessee Dateline. And that does get at one of the scarier parts of the internet. I mean, you've got all these people, and Lord knows I deal with trolls every day who do it anonymously.
But we do have the President of the United States feeding it.
Yeah.
And that's a problem.
Jared, you talked about the piece you wrote for the New York Times where you kind of went in depth on some of the people you were seeing at Trump rallies. Now you've worked on this. Is any of this hate starting to make you think twice about whether how comfortable you feel continuing to do stories about what's going on with what we hope is a minority of Trump people, the alt-right? But are you more cautious now about writing about this stuff, or do you feel I'm going after him?
You know, I think maybe it's a strange way to answer it, but I think after you've been inundated with this stuff long enough, you sort of become acclimated to it. I think about it, and of course I have to be safe, and I have to watch what I'm doing, but it actually makes me want to report more on this. The more that I sort of uncover this underbelly of both the internet and this political climate that we're in, I really want to find more. But I will say that I've talked to a lot of young enterprising journalists over the past few days in the wake of this whole controversy, and a lot of them have been talking about their safety and about how they feel shaken by this. So, I mean, it's definitely having an effect.
All right. Would you stay with us, Jared, because I want to play something that I'd love for you to be. We'll all talk about it, but you should be part of this, too. It's Friday, and we like to go back and say, what did we miss this week? What did we say we wanted to talk about, ran out of time for, whatever? And one of the things that we wanted to talk about Wednesday that we never got to was an NRA TV spot that a lot of people have not yet seen, because I'm not quite sure where they bought time. I don't know if it's just on the web. It doesn't matter. The messaging is worth our conversation. You're going to hear the voice of the woman who is the spokesperson for the NRA.
They use their media to assassinate real news. They use their schools to teach children that their president is another Hitler. They use their movie stars and singers and comedy shows and award shows to repeat their narrative over and over again. And then they use their ex-president to endorse the resistance, all to make them march, make them protest, make them scream racism and sexism and xenophobia and homophobia, to smash windows, burn cars, shut down interstates and airports, bully and terrorize the law-abiding, until the only option left is for the police to do their jobs and stop the madness. And when that happens, they'll use it as an excuse for their outrage. The only way we stop this, the only way we save our country and our freedom, is to fight this violence of lies with the clenched fist of truth. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
You know, Jason, what this echoes? This echoes President Trump's inaugural address, in which he said, the carnage stops now. Carnage. And that certainly is what this commercial suggests, is a landscape of carnage in our own country.
I got to say, when I listened to that for the first time, I was thinking it was part of the Hunger Games.
Oh, good, yeah.
Just total dystopia.
Weigh in.
This is Chip. Back to something that Jason had said earlier about about where political discourse is today in this country. I think both parties are a little bit guilty of it. That's the stuff that works. That's the stuff that gets the most views. That's the stuff that people listen to. And it's part and parcel as to why I don't do as much campaigns anymore, because I can't sit across the table from anybody in today's environment and say, I think you ought to run for public office, because it's no longer public service. It's become something that is so polarized and so deep. The nexus between campaigning and governing has never been farther apart.
And I'll just say, I mean, there's certain issues that are the most polarizing. Guns is in my view, frankly, at the top of the list.
And, you ought to know that was an issue that got you into some trouble in your governor's campaign.
And I'll tell you what, you know, if you believe that you can have a legitimate, productive conversation about guns in our current discourse, you're wrong. And I don't care who you are or what you think, but that you just played, it couldn't be less productive.
Oh, that wasn't just about guns. It was don't trust anything or anybody except us, gun group.
I don't disagree with Jason's point, but what issue today can you have an adult conversation?
That's
becoming
right.
less and less.
Jared, had you seen this commercial, or is this the first time you've heard the audio of it?
No, I've seen this quite a bit, and I've seen other ads that have also been targeted at specific individuals on the liberal left. And what strikes me about this is it's actually lifting rhetoric from a lot of the extreme right-wing sources. We're talking about InfoWars. We're talking about the more conspiracy-minded places, the clenched fist versus the violence. This is a lot of talk about who starts the violence and who's going to finish it. And I think it's incredibly irresponsible on the part of the NRA.
Yeah.
I think the growth of social media, though, has, in many respects, mainstreamed extremism on both sides, and we got to figure out how to deal with
it. Okay, but this is not some social media platform for haters. This is the National Rifle Association.
Absolutely.
All right. You know, we should point out, Lisa Clark found a veteran, Vietnam, more recent, Lisa... More recent, like Afghanistan or Iraq, who dropped out, quit the NRA when he saw this spot because he was so offended by it. Not like everybody's on this train.
No, and they're not. And that's the thing. I mean, you know, at some point, this is going to the folks are going to overplay their hand. I mean, people, in my view, you're going to see we're not at war with each other in this country. That's crazy. That might feel like that. Some people might talk like that, but ultimately we're all in this together. And what you're going to find, I think, is that the dam is going to break. There's a group of Republicans, there's a group of conservatives that are either going to turn their back on the president, that are going to turn their back on the NRA. Once that happens, once people get permission to do that, the dam is going to break and you're going to see a lot of this stuff just get left in the dust.
All right. We are out of time. Thank you to this panel for keeping us on agenda. It was really impressive. Thank you. Jason Carter, please come back. It was great having you here.
Thank you. Just don't let Buddy Darden feel like I'm taking his place.
There have been a couple more tweets saying they like having you on the show, so you should come back. And Chip, you know we always like having you on. And Jim, thank you.
I wanted a quiet 4th of July week. I didn't get mine.
Oh, no. But... we've already basically done Monday's show.
Yes.
And you really ought to join us, all of you out there. This summer is the 45th anniversary of the time in the summer in 1972 when Watergate really took off as a major national issue. It all started happening in the summer of 1972. A lot of people are saying, oh, Watergate, just like the Russian hacking, a cover-up in the White House, like the Nixon cover-up. Whether there may be some comparisons. But what Jim Galloway and I, the other day, recorded a conversation with Richard Benveniste, who was special prosecutor, one of the key special prosecutors in Watergate. He was in charge of trying to get to the bottom of the White House cover-up. We're going to go over the history of Watergate for those of you who like our history shows with him. And then he's going to talk about the areas where he does see similarities to today and where he does not. So that's at 2:00 on Monday. That was fun to do, Jim.
Yeah, he burst my bubble on the follow the money thing.
Yeah, we'll talk. You'll hear that on Monday's show. Meantime, we're completely out of time again. Jason, Chip, and Jim, thanks for being here. I'm Bill Nigut. Monday at 2, Watergate.